Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Chalk Talk. Today we have French veteran of the Second World War, Jean Jam, talking about his time fighting with the French Resistance.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great privilege to not only have John or Jean at my side, but to see a full tent, and so many of you have turned out this afternoon to listen to us. I first met John when I was researching my book on D-Day, and I wanted to make sure that the French voice in the story of 1944 was heard. And we met through a mutual friend who many here will have heard of or encountered, Professor Richard Holmes, who was my boss at the Defence Academy. And John had encountered, and we all worked at one stage for the same organisation, Cranfield University. And it was through that connection that John and I first met. And I then sat down to interview him about 2 years ago and was absolutely mesmerised by his story. And John is a torchbearer because there aren't many of his generation left. And that's the privilege partly of having him here, because he's talking to us about his own life and his own experiences. But through that lens, this is your generation and your friends who you also remember. So my job really is just to nudge John along, because there are many twists and turns and interesting anecdotes, and we've just been musing over some of them. And so I'm not going to say very much, and just encourage John to go back to those war years. And I think the first thing is a bit of context. And your father played such a big role in your life during the war, and we'll hear how and why. But perhaps you'd like to just talk a little about your family life, your father, and the events of 1940 when the Germans appear.
Yes, my father was a company commander in 117 Infantry Regiment, which was garrisoned in Le Mans in 1940. And when war was declared on the 3rd of September, his regiment was immediately sent to the Franco-Belgian frontier, where they sat for the what they call that drôle de guerre, that phony war, until the Germans decided to attack in May 1940. But my grandfather was an army officer, my father was an army officer, my two sons are British Army officers, my grandson was a British Army officer. So there is a fairly wide connection with the army way. But when my father left our house, he said to me, I was 13 and a half at the time, he said, "You are the man of the house, and you know what that means." These were my marching orders. So that was in September 1939, and I wasn't to see my father again until 1941. I will explain how and why. Our household was made up of my mother, my sister, who is still alive, and my grandmother used to live in Paris, and we arranged for her to join us in Le Mans. My grandmother remembered vividly the Prussian army occupying, first of all, laying siege to Paris, and during which time the Parisians pretty well died of hunger. And she remembers vividly, and it struck me, the uniform of the Uhlans. And I understand the Uhlans were Prussian cavalry. And they wore very, very long greatcoats, apparently. And my grandmother remembered that vividly. So she remembered the first invasion
in
1870. She then remembers 1914. Three of her sons went to war and fortunately, and quite uniquely in a way, survived. And then in 1940, the Germans invaded France and Paris again. So she had the third time in her life. So if I say she wasn't particularly well disposed towards the Germans, I think I think she had a pretty good reason, or two or three. But she was lovely, adorable. Anyway, she was with us. And when Hitler launched his invasion of Holland, Belgium, and then France, the Dutch, the Belgians, and the French all started fleeing to escape the fighting. And we had a wonderful neighbor in Le Mans who was a retired gendarme. And he said, "Would you like to leave the house?" Because everybody, it was panic. Everybody was leaving, abandoning their homes in front of the invading German army. So he agreed to drive our car and with my mother, my sister, my granny, and his wife drove his car, and we headed south to get away. We didn't get very far before the Germans caught us up. They caught us up in a little village called Mésanger, which is north, in the area around Nantes. And on the first night, the population was gathered on the courtyard outside the church, and a German officer stood on a platform and started reading it, saying, "Well, you will have a curfew from now on, and you are not supposed to be out during the curfew. And if you do anything against the German army, you will be shot." So that it was quite a shock to be told in your own country that you couldn't go out when you wanted to, and if you dared to interfere with the invaders, you might be shot. A bit of a shock, but that really set the scene. And we then became aware of what it meant to have lost one's freedom. You have, unless you've lost it, you have no idea what it means. And it hurt very deeply indeed. The country was in a state of chaos, absolute chaos. People were shattered. And I've never seen so many grown-up men cry in sheer shame. And for a young boy, it was quite... You know.
And you were 13?
And I was 13 and a half, yes, in 1940. And the armistice was signed on the 22nd of June, I forgot to say that, during the exodus, as we left, we were strafed by German fighters. There wasn't a soldier amongst us, but we were strafed by fighters, so we had to jump into ditches, and not very comfortable, but we survived. My family survived. We ended up at a farm where the farmer was extremely nice to us. I slept in the hay barn, and my granny, mother, and Madeleine slept in the beds of the farmers. They were absolutely superb. Then we had to get petrol to get back to Le Mans. So in time we did, and. When we got to Le Mans, we discovered that the Germans... Le Mans was a big garrison town. They had a list of all the French officers, and the idea was for them to billet German officers on French officers' homes. So we were told, fortunately, that the Germans were terrified of TB. So when the Feldwebel, that's an NCO and a soldier, came to our door and said they wanted to billet an officer. We had rehearsed the scene carefully with my granny, who was very tiny. I've got a picture of her. It's a pity I couldn't bring these. And she came down the corridor, coughing her head off. And I was doing German at school, and I said, excuse my German, but I remember it vividly. I said something like, "Meine Großmutter hat Tuberkulosen," whereupon the Feldwebel, the NCO, the German, crossed our names. It was incredible, but true. And we were saved. Can you imagine the humiliation of having the enemy billeted in your own home? Anyway, so we survived that, thanks to TB. Then I was sent to the lycée, grammar school at Le Mans, where very quickly our masters, most of them, were very anti-German, and our job was to make people aware that there was, that the Germans were not winning all over the place. People had to be informed, and some of our teachers used to get leaflets printed secretly, which they would dish out to some of us, very carefully selected boys, and then we would dish these out. And I remember also, De Gaulle was completely unknown in France, so I think it's later in 1940, we were issued through our teachers, just a few of us, with a small picture of De Gaulle, so that we would dish these out to make people realize that that fellow wasn't just a myth. But you can imagine what would have happened if we had been stopped by the Germans with a pocket full of pictures of De Gaulle. But anyway, one did that. We were very naughty at times because even as a boy, if you are determined to resist, to use that big word, there are so many things you can do to annoy the enemy. And we noticed that as they walked about, German soldiers used to wear their belt with the bayonet. And when they went to French cafes, they would hang the belt and the bayonet on those French coat hangers, you know. So we would walk into a cafe with a string to which we had attached our bicycle pump. And then we would very decorously hang our bayonet on top of the Germans. Their reaction was something like, "Raus!" You know, oh, they were so charming. But the French people enjoying their ersatz coffee would roar with laughter, mock the enemy, and then we would walk out. We felt we had, I mean, it sounds absolutely childish, but it just showed that we tried to make them realize that they were not really very welcome. They stole our freedom, and that is unforgivable.
And you're 14 at this stage. Yeah. And it's worth saying that Charles de Gaulle had issued a call to arms to the French after the German invasion on the 18th of June 1940. It's an incredibly important day to the French, completely missed by the British, because Winston Churchill on the same day is making his broadcast of The Finest Hour, a speech we've all heard of. And the Brits, I think, tend to think of the 18th of June as the day we won the Battle of Waterloo. So it's not surprising that De Gaulle's call to arms, incredibly important in France, has somewhat drifted into the background. But very important for you, so you're inspired by De Gaulle, and this is why you have pictures absolutely and leaflets. So
his appeal was secretly printed eventually, and we used to, and I want to pay tribute to the BBC, which kept us alive. The French service of the BBC was telling us the news as it was. We heard the German news through the Vichy state, and of course the Germans were winning all over the world. Well, actually, it was true until El Alamein, where there was at last, but at least we heard that the British were fighting on and encouraging De Gaulle to create the Free French, etc. There was a need for us to inform as many people as we could that the fight was going on. But it took a lot of doing because people were absolutely shattered, and we had rationing imposed, and very quickly we had coupons, but you couldn't get anything against your coupon because the requirements of the German army were enormous. I mean, they had enormous forces, and of course they pinched everything they could. So I remember that period as one during which I was really hungry, lots of the time. Hungry and angry.
And you were telling me, John, that the Germans had occupied not all of France, But there was an unoccupied zone, which was essentially southern.
They occupied 55% of France, and then left part of France, which was the poorest, with the Massif Central and the Alps and whatnot, whilst all the rich culturally, agricultural part of France was occupied by the Germans. So a so-called non-occupied zone was created, to which you could not travel to without a German Ausweis special permit and so on. So at the time, my father, as I think I hinted, had made his way in the non-occupied zone. We were back in Le Mans, in occupied zone, and it's not until 1941 that father managed to get one of his men to cross that demarcation line, which was in fact a border, heavily patrolled by the Germans, with a message to say that he was alive and arranged for us to meet him. So we took the train from Le Mans to Tours. When we got to Tours, we were met by a certain person who had been described very carefully to my mother, and we were taken to a little village near Blairet-la-Croix and crossed the line at night between two patrols. We stayed with some lovely people who spent all their time watching German patrols working out when it was free to get through. So we crossed and at last, in 1941, met my father again, which was quite nice. Then we had to go back to Le Mans because I was at school and that was our home. So we crossed the line again by night between two patrols. And then I went back to the lycée. By the way, two of my teachers, Monsieur Marshall and Monsieur Bouvet, were arrested, tortured, deported to Buchenwald, from which they did not come back. So that sets the scene, you know, as a child, to know that your teacher suddenly disappears. It's quite unsettling. But they were heroes to our eyes.
And equally unsettling, when we were talking in the green room, John looked out and he saw James Holland's Citroen, black Citroen car. And your reaction to that,
yes. Yeah. Well, the Gestapo were very fond of the Citroen car, which was a lovely car, very advanced mechanically at the time. So towards the end of the occupation, we managed to get hold of some of these, on which we painted the cross of Lorraine, which was our badge, and a white star on the roof so that Allied aircraft didn't machine gun us down. But it was lovely to see that car.
Even though it's associated with the Gestapo.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
John but also told me that they used to smash the window and poke a machine gun out of it, but I tried to stop him doing that with James.
Yeah. No, an LMG. And then we sat at the back with our little Sten guns, our staple weapon, and any of the men in the audience will know that Sten guns really, I think they cost about 7 and 6 pence to produce, but it was our staple weapon. The beauty of it is it could be dismantled into three parts. I've got a story about that I might have time to tell you later. Anyway, so...
So we've got your father in the non-occupied zone, running an underground movement.
Yeah, that's right. And then we are back in Le Mans, and in the summer of 1942, father arranged for us to cross the line again with false papers, and the idea was for us to stay with him in the Loche area. If you haven't been to Loche, do go to Loche. It's a lovely medieval little town in Touraine, wonderful place. Anyway, it wasn't in those days because in November 1942, the Germans occupied the whole of France. They made a beeline for Toulon, where the French fleet, some of the French fleet was. And when I say some of the French fleet, there were, and it's historically correct, 70 French ships at harbor. And their orders was not to be captured by any occupying any force. And as the Germans arrived at Toulon, 70 ships scuttled themselves So the Germans were not best pleased. But I make the point that if the Germans had seized those ships, and I'm told, I'm not a naval man, but I'm told that the French Navy at the time was quite acceptable. In 1942, when Britain was still fighting for her life, it might have made a difference. That's a point which is not often made by historians. They forget about this dash for Toulon and that in 1942. Anyway, that was...
And John, tell us how you crossed from the occupied zone.
We were once again, went from Le Mans to Tours, were met at Tours, and then we were taken to another, to Cigogne, which is another little place near Blanche. Anyway, and then we were told, you are going to cross the line in a hearse. You are the family of the corpse, and there was a corpse, and we were given papers, false papers, of course, and so that was an original way of crossing the line. Actually, the hearse was driven by gasogène, which is charcoal burning. So there was a big cylinder at the back of the thing. It was a very slow progress. Anyway, you cross the line. Fortunately, an older German checked our papers, didn't say anything. After we crossed, I looked at my mother. She was wearing a maroon hat. We hadn't been told how we would cross the line. So if the German had been properly trained, he would have been told that in 1942, when a French family loses a member, they get dressed in black from top to bottom, the ladies, and men wear a black armband. So I often mention that to people in the army, saying, whatever you do, find out the customs of your enemy so that you can fight him better.
Make sure you get the culture right.
Exactly. Anyway, so the Germans slipped up there, and then we were settled in Loche, November the occupied, and I was sent to boarding school, very Spartan place, no hot water, lousy food. Our staple diet was Jerusalem artichoke, I was a growing boy, which had no nutritive value, I'm told. The Germans pinched all the potatoes. We had a nickname for them. We called them les Dorifors. And a Dorifor is a Colorado beetle, which attacks potatoes. So we would say, oh, attention, un Dorifor. Everybody knew it, what it meant. So that was us under German occupation again. My headmaster at the lycée in Loche was a wonderful man from Alsace. I refuse to use the word Alsatian because people think of woofers straight away. People from Alsace are fantastic. They know what it's like to be French and to lose your nationality because the Germans have been pinching Alsace and Lorraine for quite a few years. Anyway, but the poor man had, as his Christian name, Adolf. And he was a headmaster in Colmar. And when the armistice was signed, he escaped from Colmar because he hated the Germans so much, became headmaster at Loche. And he then organized, and I supported him in that, the hiding of Jews who were being persecuted and of young people from Alsace and Lorraine who were conscripted to serve in the German army and who escaped to our part of the world and then used the lycée as a stepping stone towards another safe house on their way possibly to cross the Pyrenees to join the Free French, etc. They were superb people. But it was quite dangerous, really, because the Germans were on the lookout for Jews all the time and for people who escaped serving in their army. And incidentally, I read somewhere that thousands of young French people from Alsace and Lorraine, as French as they come, were killed on the Russian front wearing German uniform. Can you imagine to be killed fighting your ally at the time under the uniform of your enemy? And that applies to, I think it was about 30,000. They were conscripted into the German army.
And of course, these people who are on the run are in your school pretending to be much younger than they actually
exactly,
are,
yes.
Masquerading as students.
That's right. And what was wonderful is that I think we were about 500 students, and nobody betrayed the fact that we were taking part in that game. But we had our moments, I assure you. But people were very good. So at Loche, my headmaster, who knew my father, approached me one day and said, would you mind terribly if from time to time I ask you to take letters, documents to people, I'll tell you who. And I said, certainly not, sir. So from time to time I took secret messages to various people in the resistance in Loche. As part of my job as a schoolboy. I was a schoolboy first and foremost. So I quite enjoyed the challenge because, of course, sometimes I had to take things during the curfew hours because there was urgency. And we said, come on, take that. And, of course, if you met a German patrol, you were rather badly treated, shall we say, because you should have been tucked up in bed, not walking around, taking secret messages for the enemy.
And you were aware that your father, the army officer, was running an underground unit nearby at the time.
So he was given all sorts of jobs as cover. I mean, I remember the jobs which nearly drove him mad, he told me, was that he had a job addressing brown envelope all day and every day, I don't know what for. Anyway, that was one of the type of jobs he was given in between being very naughty, organizing his men to fight the Germans again. You had to be mad in 1940 for father to say to his men, we'll stay together and one day we shall rise and drive the enemy away. Well, you had to be insane. You should have seen the German army in 1940. I mean, they were the best army in the world at the time. They had conquered Poland and Holland and France, etc. But father had fought at Verdun. He was an absolute hero. His medals are about that long. This is the type of things people like him did. So, what else?
So you're beginning to work for the resistance,
yeah.
And you start by taking notes.
That's right, taking secret messages. I was a courier. And then in 1944, by which time I was 17, I was getting more and more involved. And before D-Day, John A. Mackey. Now, you see, you could be a member of the resistance and never touch a weapon. You could doing intelligence works, etc. But if you were a member of a Mackie, you joined an armed unit of the resistance, and the idea was to, our job was to ambush German convoys, which were, in our case, coming from southwestern France, going towards Normandy after D-Day. We were in Touraine, on their way, including we had the infamous division Das Reich coming through our area. They are the ones who sent 642 men, women, and babies into the church at Oradour-sur-Glane and set fire to it. So they went through our area doing some pretty awful things and got to Normandy later than they should have because they had been attacked and ambushed all the way up.
And you were telling me that you were doing some intelligence work before you picked up a weapon, and this was all about spotting the uniforms that the Germans wore. Mm.
That's right. I was asked once to sit by one of these Route Nationale, those long roads along which German convoys were making their way towards Normandy. And I was told, will you very carefully observe the epaulettes of the soldiers? And if they have a green piping, that means infantry. If they had a red piping, that means artillery. And I remember saying to myself, those English are mad. I mean, what the hell do they want to do with the piping of the German army? But of course, I discovered that it meant a lot, because it meant infantry regiment or you could
build up the order of battle of the Germans.
That's right. All this information was sent through the secret agents who were dropped to us and operated the secret radios.
And you never met the radio operators, because they were so carefully guarded.
Absolutely, never met any of those, but they were doing a wonderful job. Another job of ours was to, as the air war increased against Germany, more and more Allied air crews were shot down. And I always make this point at this stage. Do you realize that 55,000 Bomber Command men were killed? This is incredible. People always think of the wonderful Spitfire pilots and so on. Wonderful, yeah, but not 55,000 of them were not killed, and yet this is the price Bomber Command paid. Anyway, so as the war increased, more and more of these people were shot down. Our job was to rescue them, hide them, give them false papers, feed them, and then send them from safe house across to the Pyrenees, etc. And one of these people, and I've got here one of the boys I used to teach at Solihull School in Warwickshire in the 1950s and 60s. He will remember one of the masters at Solihull was called Bill Bale. And Bill Bale was in the Fleet Air Arm, and he was shot down over northern France in 1940, beginning of 44. And Bill broke all records. Within 3 weeks, he was back in the UK, having gone through the Pyrenees, Portugal, and back to fighting on. And he got the DFC? Yes. A wonderful man. So Bill and I felt very close. I might have met him in those days, but...
And you were helping all these pilots shot down aircraft.
Well, you were told... Oh, by the way, there's a parcel for you to take. And a parcel was one of these shot down airmen. In my case, you just went by train from Loche to Châteauroux, where my contact was le capitaine des sapeurs-pompiers. That's the man in charge of firefighter in Châteauroux. And then I would dump them. But to escort... a British airman was comparatively easy, because generally speaking, the British were about the same size as the French. The French were a bit smaller, but the Americans were enormous. and you know, you had to have a chap who detonated in a French context. I mean, the French were not as tall as these Americans were, and of course they walked differently. They do everything differently within a French context, so that was very difficult. Nobody volunteered too much for that.
John, can you remember where you were when the D-Day landings were announced?
Yeah, so early at the very beginning of June, my headmaster said, well, it's time you went and John Mackey did something nasty to the Germans with a weapon. So I belonged to an organization which was made up of lots of soldiers and officers who had fought in that awful campaign in 1940 and took refuge in the non-occupied zone. So we were well officered and well trained. So I joined the Maquis. The name was Maquis d'Epernon because our leader was called Epernon after the name of a Duke of Epernon who in the 16th century died in Loche, in the chateau at Loche. So that was his nom de guerre, Epernon. So I joined that Maquis, and my initial job was to, on my bicycle, to cover hundreds of miles in the summer of 1940, which was too hot to my liking. So I covered hundreds of miles, taking orders from our headquarters to, I'll call them platoons, which we had scattered about in farms, in tiny little farms. And my son, remember, I took my two sons back to that area when I was 90, 3 years ago. And I was able to revisit the places which were our secret HQs because we were on the move the whole time. And my job as a courier was to keep the liaison and the orders going. And we went back and it hadn't changed at all. But what impressed me most is that France is such a large country. It's vast, so I covered hundreds of miles on that bicycle. I've never sat on a bicycle since 1944. It's absolutely true. And yet, it's a wonderful sport, isn't it? But not to my liking.
Not for you.
Yeah.
So, and this is the moment at which you took up arms, you had your Sten gun.
Yeah.
And the rest of your uniform was what?
So when going in action, we used to wear an armband, an official armband. This is mine. The idea was that if we wore something, the semblance of a uniform, we would be treated like regular soldiers by the enemy. Well, of course, the enemy treated us, as you know, as terrorists. So anybody caught was automatically tortured and then disposed of, as you know. But I want to take the opportunity to pay tribute to the wonderful women of France. I mean, this was made, and they made hundreds for us with the official. It was made by people in farms and so on, women. Can you imagine what would have happened if their farm or wherever they was raided by the Germans, which did happen? They would have been immediately arrested, tortured, etc. So their names are not in books. I mean, there are lots of books about the resistance and so on, about famous agents. But the women of France, you know, did wonderful things for which they do not get any very little credit. And thousands were involved in that type of dangerous job.
And so you have the semblance of a uniform
when going in action. We khaki shirts. Quite a lot of the French army in 1940, lots of these stores had been kept in various places. So we raided those stores and tried to. There is a photo of me which I was asked to supply. And you recognized me instantly, didn't you? That lovely photo in the program. I didn't recognize myself, but I assure you it was me. So we did our work most of the work was done, apart from the liaison work, I did take part in ambushes, which meant that we would fell trees across the road. The German convoys stopped. We attacked them quickly, and then we disappeared. Our advantage is that we knew the country intimately. They didn't. But I was telling Peter, after an ambush, three of our chaps did not get away quickly enough, were captured and buried alive. And I've got the photos at home, which we took the following day, and those photos were used at the Nuremberg war trial criminal. Criminal war trials, yes. So that was the type of war. And frankly, I couldn't care less being killed. I mean, if you engage in that type of silly game, you may get killed. And I honestly didn't matter. I mean, I was young. I didn't have any kids to worry about or anything like that. But I was obsessed, haunted, like all of us, by what would happen if I were arrested and tortured. No, I knew far too much. Father was in the resistance. I knew, because of my liaison work, lots of people and places, and there is no guarantee that under appalling torture, people will not talk. But if I'm here today, it's because one of our lieutenants, Lieutenant Quires, lovely chap, was arrested, tortured, deported to Buchenwald, and came back as a living skeleton. Now, if that man, if I'm here, it's because that man clearly didn't talk under torture. So I always say I saw the worst part of man. I mean, we are beasts, basically. But at the top, man is like a pyramid, 95% animal, call it what you like, but at the top, there is a 5%. It's the spirit, the soul, call it what you like. And I think so long as we've got that at the top, we are, there is hope. So long as we maintain a faith, a belief in greater things than ourselves.
And there was a moment that summer when you were with your father and word came through of some Germans hiding in a barn.
Yeah. Yes, that was in August 1944. We were in the forest, living in the forest, and in a farm not very far from where we were hiding, three Germans said to the farmer, "We are going to spend the night in your barn, and if you tell the terrorists that we are here, we shall shoot you." And they did shoot lots of farmers and so on, terrible. But the daughter of the farmer, I think she was about 15, came to our maquis and said, "We've got three Germans, how about it?" And I said to Father, "Oh, that sounds rather exciting." So Father and I went, don't forget, it was curfew. At about midnight, we set out, breaking the curfew rules, and got to that barn, burst in shouting, "Hände hoch!" And the three Germans came to, we captured them. One of them had a superb submachine gun. They had a Schweitzer submachine gun, a beautiful weapon, 10 times better than us, than our stand. So we borrowed that for the rest of the war. The other two had just the ordinary German rifles, so we borrowed that as well. Took the chaps back to our wood, and then by the end of the war, we had captured 80. We had 80 Germans who were in a barn, in a farm, the best guarded Germans in occupied France, I assure you. But we did not maltreat them. We interrogated them, asked about their... I had a list of things which the officers had told me to ask them. How many machine guns do you have, what type, and so on. But they... And when liberation came, we handed over those 80 Germans to the Americans, who looked after them for us after that.
And John, that resulted in a citation for you.
Yes. But what is quite fascinating is that I got the quad gear and a citation mentioning, among other things, the fact that I helped capture those Germans. And my father got the quad gear, mentioning that, helped by his son, aidé par son fils, I captured three Germans, three armed Germans, in La Commune du
Président. Aged?
17, yeah. So that, I think that's quite unique for a father and son to have that mentioned in their citations.
And after the war, you met Charles de Gaulle.
Yes, in 1947, Father and I were invited to go to Alençon. We lived in Le Mans, remember? So we went to Alençon to celebrate the liberation of Alençon by the 2nd Armored Division of General Leclerc, another of my hero, pure hero. So we went, and De Gaulle was there, and I was pushed forward because I was made to wear that hot gear, and I was presented to him. And what I remember so well is the height of the man. He was very tall. Then he shook my hand and said, "Enchanté, jeune homme," delighted young man, and went on. And I had a Leica camera, which we borrowed from a German officer. and I have these photos. I've got a photo of him as he walked away. I've got that photo, which my son has not seen, of a very close-up of De Gaulle. So that was quite a day.
The war for you sort of very swiftly comes to an end as the Americans advance, and your part of France is liberated. You have to help that process along by corralling and capturing the Germans. Yes. And you want to carry on the fight, but what happens to your friends?
So a third of the French territory was self-liberated. Let me explain. After D-Day, the Allies swept northwards towards Belgium and Germany and so on, but we were south of the River Loire. So I never saw an Allied soldier because they didn't come anywhere near us. So we had, and the Germans had structures all over the country, Kommandantur, they call them, headquarters, and they stayed on and on until September. So we had to ease them out as gently as we could as they made their way away from France towards their own land. So we had fun then. Oh, but I must mention that we were utter amateurs. Against us, we had the Gestapo, the Abwehr, which was the counterintelligence service of the German army. We had the Milice, which was a unit of French traitors whose job, they were created in 1943, and their task was to get at, to infiltrate and attack resistance cells, which they did very efficiently. They were French. I mean, Gestapo, we could smell them a yard or two away, but actual French citizens, and they were armed by the Germans. We also had, in the part of France, in the Alps, the Italians occupied part of France, the Alps part, until 1943 when they packed up. But they had a secret, the equivalent to the Gestapo, which was the OVRA, who were, I'm told, as bad as the Gestapo. So these were highly professional, and by that time, I mean, they had practiced their nefarious art all over Europe, from Russia to us. And there we were, amateurs, but amateurs with a mission.
And you wanted to carry on fighting. A lot of your friends go up and they guard the perimeter of places like Saint-Nazaire.
That's right. Well, the Germans had submarine bases.
And your father says to you,
say, back to school. Because I, at 17, I was due to take the second part of my baccalaureate. So I had one more year at school, and I was furious with father because I want to carry on with my path. He said, "You've done enough, back to school." And you didn't argue with my father, I tell you. So I went back, reluctantly, back to school. But I do believe that, in fact, father probably saved my life. I tell you why. Because had I carried on with my friends, after the Germans surrendered, they were, the French army in 1946 was sent to Indochina, where they had appalling losses fighting the Viet Minh. Those who survived, that was until 1954. In 1954, those who survived were sent to Algeria until 1962. So when people tell you, well, the Frogs gave up in 1940 and waited for us to liberate them, And what were their losses? Well, in fact, I mean, they were at war until 1962. I know two of these wars were colonial wars, so that's a dirty word in some circles. But as a country, it cost them dearly in lives and expense.
But this has an interesting result, because you later on apply for a military pension.
Oh, yes. My dear sister said, why don't you apply for a war pension? So I wrote to the Ministre des Anciens Combattants, and I said I served in the Maquis for two years actively. What do I do to get a pension? And I had a letter back saying, well, services in the resistance under the age of 18 do not count. So that's what you get when you volunteer to do anything.
John is the first serviceman I've ever met who was released from military service age 17.
what I didn't say is that when I got to 18, I had to report for national service at age 18. So I went to the barracks at Le Mans, and I was passed A1 and so on. And then I said farewell to my parents. And then I was told, the colonel wants to see you. I said, well, I haven't been in the army for 2 minutes, and the colonel wants to see me. What have I done? And he said, young man, thank you very much for your services in the resistance. You are exempt military service. And I've got a scruffy bit of paper in which you say, exempté du service militaire pour décoré de la Croix de Guerre. So I was quite pleased about that, but I wish I had had a pension. I mean, the idea of a war pension when you are 18 is rather nice.
Well, time's being a chariot is almost at our heels, and I know we could go on for a long, long time, but I just thought we'd close because there's an interesting postscript to this, because your sons start writing to senior Allied commanders wanting to collect militaria after the war. Yeah. And this led to a very interesting meeting with General Montgomery.
Yes, my elder son collected militaria all his life. And he started writing to ex-Allied commanders and so on, all of whom wrote back to him. That was very telling. For instance, he has a letter from Mountbatten, who said, dear Robert, herewith a piece of braid from my wartime uniform with my best wishes and so on. Another Scottish general sent him his Tam O'Shanter. So he had quite a collection. And then I said to Robert one day, why don't you write to Monty? He said, Monty, he looks so frightening. I said, you try. So he wrote to Monty. And then about 3 days later, the phone rang, and it was Monte himself. I wish I could imitate his incredible voice. And I nearly fainted when he said, Field Marshal Montgomery. I mean, you know, not Monte, Field Marshal. Your son has written to me, and I should like you and your son to come and have tea with me. So we agreed a date. And on the given day, I said to Margaret, my lovely wife, and to my son Richard, who is here, my younger son, you come along in the car. But they were not invited. I mean, Monte didn't know they existed. So I left the car in a little sideway near Easington Mill, where Monte retired. And then at 3 o'clock, punctually, we rang the bell at Monte's house. He came down wearing his Royal Warwickshire tie and a navy blue pullover and said, you come up to my study now. And we went up to his study. And then he started talking. It was incredible. I mean, in his study, there was a painting by Churchill. And he said, I said to Winston, why, you haven't got enough sky in that picture. You know, I mean, typical Monte. And then he would say, I said to Stalin, I mean, it was fascinating. But to us, he was just like a, I think he was a very lonely man, and he saw us as a family. But I didn't say that. He said to Robert, go and fetch your mother, and so that all the four of us had tea with Monty. And then he showed us himself out, and I've got a lovely picture of him wearing white trousers and his navy blue thing. And then he said to Margaret, well, you must come again, because that was in November. He said, you must come again in the summer when my garden is particularly nice. So we trooped down again, this time all four of us officially, and we had tea with Monte. And looking across to Richard, who is here today, who was very, very slim in those days, he said to Margaret, that boy's starving. And he had a paper serviette with M of A, Montgomery of Alabama, in the corner. And he emptied a whole bowl of them and gave that to Richard. Eat that on your way home. And then I have lovely letters he would write to me. My dear James, I want to buy a tape recorder. What do you suggest I get? You know, it was lovely. A grandfatherly figure to us. But I'm so glad that we met him, because we met him. He was older, but he had all his... And then we kept in touch, and towards the end, I would get the housekeeper said, the field marshal is resting and he's very weak. But it was a lovely story.
And that's a lovely, lovely note to finish on. John, it's been absolutely fascinating, humbling, wonderful. You've taken us all the way through France and into happier post-war times. And I think we'd all love to pay tribute to your service. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.